Hello, welcome to Waldman's Words, sans Emily Burke, but with Raymond Rasmussen. And hopefully I didn't butcher his last name. I don't think I butchered his first name. It's a common theme where I bite your list names. Today is Halloween, but when this episode airs, it'll either be late November or early December. So I hope you all had a good Thanksgiving and are prepping for some Chanukah and some Xmas. I don't even want to start to describe Ray Rasmussen because the dude is a hyphen hyphen. He knows a lot. And if you're ever on Facebook, you should definitely subscribe to his page because he imparts knowledge to upstart bands, upstart engineer, producers, everyone. And execs high and low can learn a lot from him, and bands high and low as well. You are never too knowledgeable to learn more. So the next few weeks on Waldman's Words are going to be great. We've got another person from PeerTrax, the blockchain music network that hopefully will really, really take part in the general airwaves of the world soon. We've got Eddie Deal, who is actually the head of the company. Thank you again, Jamie Roberts, for hooking that up. Right during the infancy of the company, we had Cedric Coban on the show. So happy to start 2018 with him on actual not much notice and end it with Eddie Deal. He's a nice dude. And the following week is going to be cool because one of my best friends from growing up, Dave Prince, who I was in a band with in high school called We Are Groove Animals, and also whenever Lido Beach, which is my project, plays in New York, he either plays guitar or bass. He's in a band called Taylor and the Apes, and like we usually say on the show, we don't always have musicians on. We started that way, but now it's mostly behind the scenes. But we've got Taylor from Taylor and the Apes, and his last name is Anspaugh. So hopefully I didn't butcher that one as well. But we're going to talk about, I guess, being a working musician in New York City. And his band is not, you know, topping the charts right now. So how he supplements and pays for all the expenses. Like they just released a new video. They just released a new record. They play shows. So it's expensive living in New York. It's the second most expensive city in America, actually. And that's something we could probably talk about with Raymond Rasmussen, too, how he's not in one of the big three. But, you know, you could do it anywhere. So I'm excited to have Taylor on. And I know that we have a bunch of stuff backlogged, but I will be in New York for Thanksgiving when we normally would be recording. And then the following week, we've got Kevin Kay on the show. And basically, Kevin's domain is entertainmentsponsorshipgroup.com. So I won't say anything else other than it's a lot of learning, a lot of weeks. So every single Tuesday night, 5 o'clock Pacific time, 8 o'clock Eastern time, Walden's Words airs on Adobe Live. I mean, it's not technically live because it's recorded, but for the first time live, meaning. So live in quotes. Rerunning every single Sunday morning at 5 a.m. Eastern. No, sorry. Whoa, I need more coffee. 5 a.m. Pacific, 8 a.m. Eastern. Immediately after the episode gets broadcast to Adobe on Tuesday in the quote-unquote live world, it gets uploaded to the adobe.com website. You could stream every single episode for free. We're in the hundreds, which is fucking nuts. And you can go on the podcast app on iTunes, download, subscribe for free. Just go ham, go nuts, and stick around for Raymond Rasmussen and enjoy these commercials, songs, and don't enjoy missing Emily Burke. I definitely don't. I miss her. All right, we are here on Waldman's Words, and Mr. Ray Rasmussen, did I pronounce that right? I sometimes fuck that up.
No, that's pretty good. Yes. You could go Rasmussen, you could call it Rasmussen. I've gotten worse than both of those, so
Rasmussen.
You did it pretty well.
Okay, yeah. Good. Well, I mean, my degree's in English, but your last name looks a little bit foreign. Where's I guess, that delineate from?
As far as I know, Norway.
Okay.
I know my great-grandparents, well, my great-grandfather was from Norway and kind of came down from that way. The original, like where it came from originally, I'm not really sure. But I'm going to go with Norwegian because it sounds cool.
I mean, there's two things I think about Norwegian. I think this Bird Has Flown, the Beatles song, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I sat in a rug by Tinker Time. And also, I think that you're kind of a bearded Nordic god. So let's just start with that.
Yeah.
Right away.
Well, yeah, that's pretty good. And the third that I would add to that is decent black metal.
Okay. Or Ray Davies. Anyway, I'm done with that segment, so I hope you're enjoying your coffee. Where am I speaking to you? Where are you right now?
I'm in Dayton, Ohio.
Fuck yeah, dude. I went to school in the Midwest, in Ann Arbor, so don't hate me, but I lived there for 4 years.
That's fine. You know, I don't understand the animosity between Ohio and Michigan. I'm sure it's sports related, which would explain why I have no idea why it exists.
It's 100% sports related, and I am on your side of the equation, but it is actually the biggest football rivalry in college, Ohio State, Michigan. I don't care. And when someone gives me shit, I'm just like, did you play for the team? And I went right. there for academics, and that shuts them up each time. So I'm proud of that.
That's funny. Yeah, I listened to the episode this morning. I listened to the one you did with Tyler Smith, Danger Kids.
Damn right.
Yeah, him and I, we sort of grew up in the same music scene even. So not only are we from the same town, but we were sort of around each other sort of during those formative teenage years where you're trying to like figure out, one, you know, where you fit in socially, but also what types of things you like to create. Well, with your art and that kind of thing. So that's been really fun to see him, because he was the standout in the local scene anyway. Mm-hmm. And then to see him go off and do what he's done has been, I don't know. I don't know if I can feel pride for that kind of thing, but I feel a little bit
feel
pride. Happy to see somebody, you know.
I mean, I did not grow up with Billy Crystal. He's a scotch older than me, but he went to my high school. So I'm proud to say that our hometown produced someone that's not a meth head. So I'm just really excited about that. And maybe he is a meth head, maybe just a functional one. But you, I guess before you got into music on your own, were you reared in a musical environment?
In a manner of speaking, basically the way my life worked out, I mean, this is going back. This is like origin story stuff.
Go for it.
Okay, so my dad wasn't around too much when I was younger. I mean, he pretty much wasn't around at all. And so that left my mom as basically a single mom, right? So when I went to school, it was all gravy. Like, you know, she had childcare throughout most of the day, and then we would get off. You know, I'd get off school, she'd get off work about the same time. So that was cool. However, in the summers, that screwed everything up. So what she would do is she had me go down to Florida. And in Florida is where I had the one positive male role model in my entire life, which was my uncle, and he was a musician. He had picked up guitar kind of late. When he was in Korea for 2 years, he just started, fiddling around with the guitar, and I just thought he was so cool. So he bought me like a little nylon string classical acoustic, and I started with that, and that would have probably been about first grade.
Oh, wow, you're super young.
Yeah, but then what would happen is I'd come back home, and I think my mom had like a tambourine and she'd listen to like Blue Oyster Cult and play her tambourine, but there really wasn't like musicianship there. It was really honestly me idolizing my uncle and trying to be more like that. You know, like some young boys that try to be more like their dad. And I'm like, well, I'm going to be more like my uncle because he's got tattoos and jumps out of airplanes and kills people. And I think that's cool.
He's technically the cool uncle.
He's very much the cool uncle. He's still that way, man. He's very cool.
So, I mean, when I used to tour and I would come home from tour, I would teach guitar lessons. And I always tell people the youngest I will teach someone is 6 years old, just because you don't have the motor skills or the attention span to really handle it. Did you find that? Because I guess first grade is like six or seven, correct? So did you find that was a really good year to, I guess, invigorate start your passion for music?
I think so. I think starting off with a classical acoustic was good too. It felt like something. One, it wasn't like playing a steel string acoustic where it was so difficult on my fingers, but then also the size of the guitar was much smaller. So that was a lot, that probably played into it as well. You know, I think sometimes like with kids, it's about making those first few steps, like creating as little friction as possible there. Mm-hmm. And for me, I think having that nylon string classical guitar helped me sort of get over that initial initial learning, well, not just a learning curve, but the physical barriers that come with, you know, learning to play an instrument, you know?
The gateway drug to fearing the Reaper, I assume.
Right, exactly. You start with, you know, that's why, like, you remember when, I don't know if Guitar Hero is still super huge, but, you know, everybody's playing Guitar Hero, and people were, you know, some people were shitting on it, some people were, like, stoked about it, it's cool, I mean, whatever. But what I saw was kids, again, having another, you know, it's a, I guess probably a gateway drug is a good way to think about that. It's a very simple, very basic version of an actual skill set, and it's one step, I mean, even lower than picking up a guitar, right? It's just the basic standing there in that sort of stance, mm-hmm. getting some type of positive feedback
rhythm.
By just
you're working on some rhythm. Yeah. I mean, granted, a lot of the best guitarists I know really sucked at Guitar Hero, but
sure.
At least, I mean, I don't know how old you are. I'm 37, but mm-hmm. when I moved to LA, I just graduated from, you know, the hated University of Michigan, and School of Rock was actually an impetus for a lot of people to get into music. So whatever gets you in, man, I'm stoked
on
that.
Whatever.
So I guess as a teenager, well, how old are you? Unless you don't want to age yourself.
That's okay. I'm 28.
Holy
just
shit.
Just turned on the 25th, so 6 days ago.
Dude.
I
mean, after reading your posts, you definitely seem like at least 29. So I'm really honored.
Well, shoot.
Yeah. That's 365 days. Holy shit.
That is. Well, that's significant. It can be.
I mean, a year. I mean, 1 year later is a really good Get Up Kids song. So I guess I can't believe I referenced that. I'm proud of myself. So I guess
you're good at these references. I got to give you that. You're good at this. All kinds of – even going back and listening to the other episodes. Like you definitely have a good knowledge of the
You can't see me. I'm smiling. I have the hugest shit-eating grin. But keep going. Keep complimenting me. This is great.
Well, I sort of what I mean to say is, like, you're really good at, like, picking out bands and songs and the way and, like, pulling from references, right, from kind of all the source material. My memory is so it's so limited, where it's like I might know something today if it has something to do with what I'm doing right this second, mm-hmm. but then next week I'll totally forget it. So like if you ask me like what bands I even like, I will like forget every single band that exists. And the fact that like you can pull things out of like thin air, I find that really impressive.
Well, I find what you do, and we can get into this later on Facebook. Sure. I mean, the advice, I mean, I really sincerely thought you were my age based on the amount of insight and knowledge you have, and we'll get into that, but I mean you're very articulate in how you kind of, you could speak to a kid who's just learning how to be in a band, you could speak to an executive. So thank you for complimenting me, and feel free to do so publicly. But no, my assistant Emily Burke, who's amazing, shout out to her, she's actually not here, she does a lot of the shows with me when she's in town, she sent me quite a lot of bullet points on you, and that's what I try to do, especially with someone that I don't really know, like we don't really know each other, but I really, because you hit me up, you're like, okay, so what are we going to talk about? I'm like, we're just going to talk, man. I really, really wanted to feel like, you know, when someone sends you a text and you know that they labored over it for days and edited it, I don't know, it just doesn't feel as organic as like a real convo. And we've been talking for the past 73 hours. I don't know if you realize that time has flown. So what music did you get into besides the Get Up Kids 1 year later in Ohio?
My first, the first album I ever had was a compilation CD that was, it was called Hot and Heavy. And I have no idea like who put it out. I just remember it being a compilation of like that, you know, that song, Godzilla, it's like,
Yeah, was that Blue Oyster Cult though? Godzilla?
Maybe it was.
I'm gonna look it up.
Something like that.
I mean, Godzilla. That's. I think it is Blue Oyster Cult. I'm gonna look this up just so we can learn.
Yeah, and then like Cat Scratch Fever. I remember that song too.
That guy is huge in the Midwest. Yeah, when I think of Godzilla, I also think of like the P. Diddy Cashmere Come With Me that was on the Godzilla soundtrack. All right. Blue Oyster Cult, go. Godzilla. Yeah, dude. Godzilla. Blue Oyster Cult.
Cool. So I guess Blue Oyster Cult was one of the first ones, because that's one I remember. I saw them at a, I don't know if it was a state fair, but it was some kind of
fair. It was 100% a state fair. I'm just definitely telling you that right now. They're that kind of band.
Well, right next to like the funnel cake stand. Ooh. Like right there.
Right next to the healthy gluten-free stand. It's perfect.
I think I missed them at their peak. If they were playing my state fair, I think I probably missed them.
I think actually, you missed them at the peak because of the day and time you were born. I think Blue Oyster Cult probably peaked in the late 70s, early 80s. I mean, granted, like the people that shit on that, it's like, try having one hit. But Blue Oyster Cult, when I Google Blue Oyster Cult Godzilla, just so you know, the first link that comes up is Vegas.com. And it says Blue Oyster Cult Showtimes and deals. So I don't know. Maybe they need to work on their search optimization. But anyway, so right. Blue Oyster Cult, did you get into performing then, or were you just like consuming music like crazy then?
I was consuming for sure. By the time I was starting to play, let me think about who was like influenced. I guess it would have been Blue Oyster Cult at that point, mm-hmm. and a little bit of like Lynyrd Skynyrd and that kind of stuff. But it was one of those things where I got introduced to music at that point, but it didn't really become serious for me until I started getting into my teenage years. And that was a result. I think it was mostly social pressure. It was like just to sort of contextualize this a little bit, you know, I grew up, we were super poor, but we lived on the edge of like a really like kind of affluent town. And my mom strategically bought the house that she bought so that I could go to the good school system, right? I had a great mom, so she was and very smart. And she's like, okay, I want him to have a good education. So I ended up shitting all over that, but that's a whole other – that's another part of that story.
Well, at least you started the foundation before you defecated. So good right. for you. And by the way, Blue Oyster Cult, just so you know, I just learned this, and thank you, because yeah. I can guarantee you you're probably the first person on this entire Adobe station to talk about Blue Oyster Cult. But they're from Long Island, and I'm from Long Island, and I had no idea. And you wouldn't believe this, but they started in 1967. I did not realize that they were around. They fucking paid their dues. And Oyster has those two little dots above the O, kind of like what I would picture Rasmussen would have yes. on it. But anyway, go back to the really rich high school you went to.
Sure, sure. Okay, so as you can imagine, you know, being the poor kid who goes to a rich kid's school, it's kind of hard to fit in. I didn't really do the typical school stuff, right? I didn't go to football games. I didn't do extracurriculars.
You just drove your Maserati around.
Right, exactly. So, you know, I didn't really fit in at school. Well, I had this buddy of mine who, his name was Jimmy, and he had an older brother named Derek. And Derek was really cool, but he was like that punk cool. He was listening to like Dashboard Confessional but he was like, you know, he was skateboarded and shit like that, right? So he was really cool, and he was like, somehow he sort of what fit in with the kind of the preppy crowd there. Anyway, Derek had friends. That was his name, was Derek. And Derek, he would let us tag along from time to time when he was doing stuff. And one thing that he was doing one weekend was he was going to a show.
Wait, what was the age gap, though? Because what was the age gap? Because I know growing up there's a ginormous difference between an 11 mm-hmm. and a 12-year-old and a 12 and a 13-year-old. Like, there's a huge social
Definitely.
Difference.
Yeah, he's 4 years older.
Oh, 4 years strong.
Yeah. So your references are incredible.
Zing.
I mean, truly, you're on point. It's wonderful.
Two cups of coffee. All right.
There you go. So what happened was, Derek started, he let me kind of tag along with these shows, and Jimmy, he went to maybe a couple of them, but like when I went to the shows, I had this wonderful experience because when I looked at all of these people who were going out to the shows, they were all people like me pretty much. They were all kids who really didn't fit in at school. You know, if you had the option of, you know, on a Friday night going to a football game or going to a local show, you know, you can sort of figure out like which demographic will go to one or the other, right? So then these yep. local shows, it was the one place where every weird kid could go and they would fit in. And it wasn't like judgmental. It was like, hey, we're all weird together and it's fun, right? So
it reminded me of Varsity Blues for some reason, because like yeah. how the football games were that crowd. And then like the kid in the household who was on the crucifix, the alternative kid. Like that, mm-hmm. I was on Long Island. I would go to ska shows at Deja One, so I was the Ray of Long Island, just 833 years older.
There you go. And so what ended up happening was, you know, this was one place where I felt like I could fit in, right? Which was big for me, you know, having kind of a rough, rough home life. Like, it felt good to have a place where I could go. And luckily enough, I already had built some kind of skill set around the guitar. So I was like, okay, well, I'm really going to go all in on this guitar thing because maybe I can finally get some friends, right? I mean, that sounds so sad now, but that's exactly what I thought. I was like, I want to go all in on this because whatever this community is, you know, and you see these people on stage where, you know, when you're young and there's, you know, 50 people in the crowd, that seems like a lot, right?
So it's
these people in these like shitty local bands basically who are like, know, they're up there. They seem like they're having a good time. People are high-fiving them. You know, it's just that sort of like, I'm like, wow, I would really like to do that. So then I went all in on that. And then that would have probably been, I would have probably been in middle school when I really started taking like guitar seriously. And actually then I ended up going to drums because just out of necessity, there were tons of guitar players, right? And no drummers. So then I did drums and I did that for quite a while.
But a lot of people make friends through groups like that. Like I can tell you that my wife still tells me that she still talks to people from her Pee Wee soccer group. So it's like those athletic kids bond together and hang out. And you know, the friends that I hung out with in high school through music were the groomsmen at my wedding. So, I mean, that when you feel really alone, especially during the time of pimples and voice changing and all that stuff, it's good to feel like you have a home because, of course, your parents don't understand you. And you also grew up, you know, in a single mother household. Unless did she remarry or?
She remarried, but the gentleman she married really wasn't that present either. He was sort of there, but he wasn't exactly a father figure. Nice guy, but a little bit of a he dabbled in a lot of drugs. One thing he would do is he would disappear. Well, he would disappear for like 2 days and like we would not know where he was. And it turned out that he had been riding around town. He had done a bunch of coke and he was riding around town on a bicycle.
Oh, no.
And now looking back, I'm like, that's hilarious. I'm imagining this old, you know, sort of older guy on a coke binge riding around town. But back then it was weird because it was like, you know, it was just there was no stability.
Right.
And I think that was one of those things that it was like it caused me to do a lot of things. One was try to be the stability in my household. But
that's what attracts a lot of people to music, though, or, you know, surroundings. Like, I mean, look into the Beatles. They all grew up in squalor and broken homes and all those issues, and that I guess inspires some of the best art of all time. And believe it or not, we're almost done with segment one. We are fucking killing it. Continue.
Dude, nailed it.
Nailed it.
And I think part of that too is that sort of need to have control and be stable caused me to want to get into entrepreneurship versus having a job because I never liked the idea of having somebody else in control of my stability. So that's what led me into business.
Well, we could talk about exactly what business you went into because, again, you're a hyphen and I want to focus segment two on that. But I guess tell me about, I guess, the tail end of your high school career and were you a drummer in a band? Were you a guitar player in a band? Or at the time, it wasn't as frequent to have just a screamer in a band. So like what were you doing for your own personal creative outlet? And then we'll take a short break.
Sure. I was primarily playing drums for most of the time that I was an active like musician playing in bands. When I got into sort of my mid-teens, it became obvious to me that I probably wasn't going to be a touring musician and that I should try to find something that kept me at home but allowed me to still be in music. And that's when I started getting into recording.
At least you knew. I mean, I earn the bulk of my income actually managing producers, so I get it. And usually, I mean, maybe not in your case, they're more stable. But the thing is, it's like it's good that you knew because there's some people that just still don't know that they can't hang, even with Pro Tools.
Sure.
So I guess we'll get into that in a second. Is there any incredible adjective you would like to use to describe this segment, which I guess touches upon 0 to 18? And again, special shout out to the cool uncle in Florida, Blue Oyster Cult. So is there any adjective you'd like to leave the tens of gazillions of listeners right now?
Am I sort of summarizing in a way?
You could do whatever you want. You could summarize this thing. You can use an adjective to describe the buildup that you had for being so excited about this interview. You could describe the past 20 minutes, or you could just use an adjective to describe, you know, Dayton in general. Whatever you want. This is yours, and I know this is some hardcore pressure. Don't think too much, Ray. You got this.
Complicated.
Ooh, like Avril Lavigne complicated or complicated, you know, just how it was like all over.
Avril Lavigne complicated.
Okay.
And I don't know what that means. I just love Avril Lavigne.
She's a fucking force, man. She's a motherfucking princess. All right, so stick around for the second half where we talk about, I guess, your smart decision to go behind the scenes and what you do on social media, because I am enthralled. I mean, I can tell you that I definitely have not unfollowed you. I enjoy reading your posts. Some of the people that you interact with, I don't enjoy them, but I enjoy you, and we'll be right back. All right, we are back with Ray Rasmussen, Ray R, alliteration. Oh, Ray, alliteration. Look at that.
Damn it, you're so clever.
I am so clever, except at home, I could literally say like a Robin Williams style routine that probably generated more laughs than the entire network of Comedy Central. My wife will look at me stone cold.
Yeah, wives are like that. I've got one myself, and she. What's so great about wives, and what's so great about kids, especially kids, are really.
You're a father, though.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I've got a 2-year-old.
Whoa.
And what's wonderful about those people, if you've got good ones, they keep you humble. That's for sure.
Well, kids don't lie, man. If they don't like something, if they're not happy, they are so forthright. I don't know when they become liars.
I heard Steven Tyler talking about it one time where he was like talking about how his daughter, he's like, you know, Steven Tyler, he's been playing, you know, he's been performing in front of, you know, 30,000 people worshiping him as a rock god since like forever, right?
Yep.
And, you know, he gets in the car with his daughter and she's like, I want ice cream. He's like, okay, honey, like, well, you know, we'll go get ice cream. He's like, I want ice cream now. She doesn't care who he is. She's like, I want ice cream and you're getting it for me. My daughter's the exact same way. You know, it's like, I'm not, you know, I just part of my work, right? I have these sales teams that I manage and I've got people who like I'm responsible to and for, right? Mm-hmm. Even some of the companies that I consult for, it's like everybody refers to each other as like, sir. My daughter doesn't care.
Nah, she doesn't give a shit, dude.
No, we were at Waffle House this morning, and she's like, I'm getting out of my chair.
Oh,
and there's nothing you can do to stop me. So she's screaming, and I'm like, it's like a hostage situation. That's what it feels like having a 2-year-old. It's just a hostage situation.
Well, you just reminded me of the meme that went pretty global of the singer of Slayer, like, rocking out at the Grammys. I just Googled it. I guess this episode is brought to you by Google. But I Googled it, and the daughter is like, yeah, fucking lame-o. And that was a popular meme. It's no matter what, like, I'm trying to think, like, who would be, like, the total personification of cool for people. I mean, maybe it used to be Keith Richards because he's the missing link and his daughter's like, all right, bro, like, get off your high horse. So I guess behind – who was the very first band that you sat behind the computer for? Like, because you're definitely not – unless you were using tape. But, like, tell me about that, because that's a lot of trial and error, isn't it?
Yeah, well, let me just say that I've been so extremely lucky at so many critical points of my life. You know, even starting from the beginning, like we were talking about, having a rough home life, now I look at it as that was a huge advantage for me because I learned to be uncomfortable. I learned to sort of, you know, think independently and whatever, right? So all of that sort of led up to my middle teenage years where I had all of these friends who were doing music. And of course, when you're trying to do music, the issue of recording always comes up, right? Well, the problem was that none of us really had any money. So just because I'm me, I'm like, well, is there a way that maybe we could do this on our own? I was very lucky to look into that at a time where inexpensive audio interfaces were really hitting the market.
What year would you say this was?
That would have been 2000, probably 2005, 2000, yeah, probably around 2005, 2006.
Yeah, just before that, you had to have a lot of money to be able to record, unless you wanted to do it to like a Casio tape deck.
Exactly. My first audio interface was the PreSonus FirePod, which preceded even the FP10. It became the FP10. And so I picked up the FirePod. I had this really crappy computer that I think had like 1 gig of RAM, and I even forget how large the hard drive was, not at all. And some of these event, I forget the monitors I had. Anyway, so I was able to sort of buy these things and then just sort of by trial and error started to figure out this recording thing. I think what people forget now is how I think they take for granted the educational resources that are available now. Because back in 2005, none of that existed. There was no URM, you know, back then. There was no YouTube back then. Like, you had to figure out recording either by going to forums, which the Andy Sneap forum was huge for me, but then there was also, you know, just books that were written by people who had gear that like far outstripped
you couldn't
yours,
be as
right?
lazy as you are now, like just go on Facebook and write a comment and then get an influx, like, I don't know, I can go into the entitled generation anyway, keep going, sorry. I digress.
Sure. So again, that was another reason why I was lucky, right? There, the technology was there. But what was cool was that the culture didn't realize, it hadn't caught up with the tech yet. So when I came along and I said, you know, the local studio in town, which was ran by a bunch of guys who could maybe do like country and classic rock, but my friends are all doing metal. But when even the big studio is priced at $60 an hour and none of us have jobs, it was like, again, that was another opportunity for me, because one, I was into metal. Two, the tools were really inexpensive. And also
the Pro Tools. Were really inexpensive. Well, I just said, ooh.
The Pro, there you go. But even then, I think I started off using Reaper, and I still use Reaper to this day. Like, that's the workstation I use. And also, again, at that time, some free amp sims came out that worked really, really well, too. They're, you know, the like Nick Crow and stuff like that. Like, so I was just so insanely lucky. Anyway, so I started recording these, you know, crappy local bands. Initially, it was bands that I was in, and then those bands kind of got better and better and better. Luckily, if I thought about what band was the first one that I was like responsible for, I don't think that I could tell you, because it started off as just some friends who were trying to do a band, and then that one fizzled out, and then, you know, then there was another one. I never worked with any, I should also sort of say this too, I've never worked with anybody who went off to do anything like super huge, right? I also ran that business profitably and full time it was full time. I mean, I guess you can consider it like full time once I became an adult. So then I ran it 5 years after that.
Did you have any other jobs concurrently? Because that's difficult to do, especially in a market like Dayton or the Ohio area where, you know, there's not as much money.
You would think that, but I was also the only one besides Joey Sturgis, right? I mean, there was obviously Joey, who was only an hour away. But if you were talking about Dayton or Columbus or Cincinnati, I was the guy doing metal for cheap at that point. I was doing $100 a day. Like, how, you know, that's super, super cheap. Mm-hmm. I did have, when I got into sort of, you know, when I had slow months, I would get like just a part-time job to get myself, you know, through that little hump. And then I would just quit that job, usually almost never giving 2 weeks' notice. I'm like, okay, I got enough. I'm good. You know, but eventually I was working, let me think, 25 days a month at $100 a day. Mm-hmm. And I was 18, I was probably 19 by the time that it was going that well.
Did you live with your mom at the time, or did you move out on your own?
No, I had a really crappy apartment and I had a roommate. And I mean, all told, my expenses were probably $500 a month.
Oh, wow.
So I was doing pretty, I mean, when your overhead is that low, I mean, if I only have to find work for 5 days out of the month to cover that overhead, it becomes really, really attainable to be full time. You know what I mean?
Well, you didn't have a child at the time and you weren't married at the time.
It was a lot easier then.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It was
a
lot easier.
It's a young man's game.
Yeah. Well, and that's something I think people sort of forget, is that if you want to, there are two ways to being financially, to financial freedom, right? There is making more and needing less. Needing less is a hell of a lot easier sometimes than making more. It's the thing that you can really control, mm-hmm. right? It's the reason why my wife and I have an expensive home and I don't drive a Bentley. You know, it's like, you know, I prioritized my time, you know, my time spent doing something I love over having things, which has benefit for me, you know?
Do you find that you use that when you're writing, though? Because, like, I know that we're going a few different places, but what exposed me to you was not the work you did in audio, but the wisdom and sure. what you do. So, like, were you doing things, I guess, at the medium at the time? Because that's where my research comes in, you know, like a little bit of that. Like, because mm-hmm. was that a concurrent thing, or was that as you were getting older and having more and more responsibilities, i.e. being married and, you know, being a father, is that when you really got more introspective and trying imparting?
Well, basically what happened was I did the studio thing until I was in my early 20s. I was probably 22 or 23 when the studio thing kind of started to slow down. Just for whatever reason, I just wasn't getting – probably competition was higher. There were a lot of guys in my area who were doing it really well. I just wasn't the guy anymore, right? So things really started to slow down. And as a result, I decided to turn to another passion of mine, which had been investing, which is a really weird passion, but it was just something that I was into. So I was primarily trading Forex.
I'm and
I was
from doing New that, York, dude. There's a lot of people with that passion there, or the quote-unquote passion.
Sure. So I did that. I decided, I'm like, okay, I'm going to switch to this. And I know that if I can get X, you know, if I can make X amount per month, again, my overhead was super low. I know that I could probably do this full time. Of course, it didn't go according to plan. I ended up having to get little side jobs to make ends meet, whatever, right? But I sort of like decided, I'm like, okay, I'm going to do this investing thing. Eventually, I caught my stride. That went well. I built up enough of a track record that I was able to wrangle my first like client, and he gave me a pretty decent amount of money. And I said, look, I'm going to give you, you know, I'll give you a percentage of this, and I'll guarantee a certain percentage of your losses as well. So there's no risk with going to me. The risk is all on my side. So I did well with him. The nice thing about rich people is that they talk, and then was able to bring in more people and wrangle more money. And so then I ended up starting a hedge fund, which was pretty much my bread and butter for a while.
I had no idea. That's really awesome that you brought that sure. up. And we actually, in the intro, we talked about bringing some different facets of the industry on. And we could, I mean, you could probably give money advice to musicians, but we have people in the blockchain world kind of entering as well. So, mm-hmm. I mean, a lot, if you've delved into the show, a lot of it are artist managers, A&Rs, so it's cool. Did you ever work with any prolific clients in that regard? And then I really want to talk about the advice that you do. You're kind of like the Dear Abby of my Facebook world. So you're Dear Ray or Right Ray. I don't know.
Sure. Well, as far as like prolific clients that I've had, are you talking as far as the music thing, or are we talking
anything
more with the
finances? I mean, did you have like Steve Jobs as a client? Like, I'm just trying to think.
I didn't. I had, there are a bunch of like kind of no name people. It's like, I think we just don't really know how much wealth is out there in these different pockets, right? Like we talk about the 1% owning, you know, a huge percentage of the total wealth.
Like 99% of it. It's like
absolutely.
Crazy.
Yeah, but we don't think about who these, like this 1% of people are, right? I mean, it's like if you look at a rich neighborhood, not all of them are doctors, right? You know, there's a huge amount of variety out there. So the people that I've worked with, one, they're super private, so I can't like really give out names, but they tend to have either inherited their wealth or they've had, usually it's not one business that's had the, created the most of their cash flow. Usually they have like a bunch of tiny businesses. Like one guy is, I joke with him, I call him a slumlord. He owns a bunch of, like trailer parks. And what he'll do is he'll buy the trailers, he'll buy the whole thing, and then he'll rent those out. And his reasoning was, okay, look, if I buy, you know, $500,000 worth of trailers, I can always sell half, you know, I can sell $250,000 worth of trailers pretty easy. He's like, if I bought one house that was worth $500,000, it's not like I can sell off one room. So for him, it was like, it was a liquidity thing. A lot of the people that I work with are those types of people who they're not in sexy businesses at all. They're just in like,
do you think audio engineering is sexy? It's definitely not. So like, no. I definitely would not use that word to describe it. But I mean, I did sure. use the word to describe you as a hyphen. So this is just a hyphen that I didn't even know about, but
sure.
we only and have like five. Well, oh, say what you got to say, because I'm curious, because I'll come up with an adjective, enthralled. All right, your turn, go.
Sure. So just the one last thing about that. I ended up also getting into kind of corporate consulting because I missed owning a business. I missed the entrepreneur aspect. So that's another one of my hyphens, is that the hedge fund didn't really scratch my entrepreneur itch because it's just me looking at charts and making decisions. So then I started consulting for my rich clients, kind of their side projects. And that's also kind of another one of my hyphens, which that leads into the next part.
Well, that's bipolar, because now you do consulting for like the really poor gutter punk musicians. So it's like,
right. And I think, well, so that's what got me, that's what makes me comfortable in saying the things that I say, because that's something that I got early on, you know, before I had sort of proven myself by just flooding the internet with my little ideas. People are like, what bands have you managed? What, you know, success have you had in the music industry? And I'm like, none, besides I ran a music, you know, a recording studio for a number of years. But I have worked in like half a dozen other industries. And one thing that I've learned by working in all of those industries is that minus a few details here and there, it's all pretty much the same. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're trying to run your band as, you know, if you're trying to make money out of your art, it automatically becomes a business. Yep. You know, the people who get mad at me are the ones who are like doing it for the art, and they like, they don't want to think about it as a business. But I'm like, as soon
then
as you start,
then it's a hobby, and they need to delineate.
Sure. And they can ignore everything that I say. If it's a hobby for you, ignore everything I say.
Why read what you're saying when it's the opposite intended effect? It doesn't make sense. 100%. So I guess this is where the advice comes in, and not what advice do you have for Waldman's Words to get better, but like, that's how I found you. I don't know who added who, but it's like probably been a Facebook presence in my life for a year or so, and you have a lot of things to say. You have a lot on your mind, and a lot of it is, I guess, geared towards upstart bands or upstart audio engineers. So this is your forum to talk about that. Like, how did you get an audience? How did people give a shit about you?
Well, it's weird the things that catch on, that's for sure. Basically, there was just one day where I decided, you know, because I had done, you know, some pretty cool things with some of the cash-strapped businesses that I had, right, or the cash-strapped businesses that I was working with. And I was like, I wonder if these things could apply to bands. I see no reason why they couldn't. I mean, basically, bands are little entertainment companies, right? Just like any other, like, event business, right? It's very similar to, like, even almost like catering, almost. It's very, you know, there are a lot of parallels there. So I was like, okay, what I'm going to do is I'm going to start thinking about things that apply to, you know, these fledgling cash-strapped startups, and look at if they apply to bands and music, right? Mm-hmm. So I just started, I just decided, I'm like, every day I'm going to say something. And I just started doing that, and I probably had done it for about 2 months, and then I had one post that did particularly well. I think I said, musicians want career level results for a hobbyist level commitment. Mm-hmm. And then that one went like, you know, I forget, it had like thousands and thousands of shares, yada, 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 right?
I think,
and
that's the, how I found out about you. I think it was that post.
I believe it. The irony of that, though, and this is just so funny, like, you never know like what's going to be the thing. I almost didn't post it because it just felt like such a mediocre, like, obvious idea. Mm-hmm. Right? And I had posted stuff that was probably way more like introspective and smart, like, before that, you know, and it'd get like one like,
but that's not
likes.
That's not as retweetable. It's more of like a bullet point, like in a movie theater ad, like the tagline. That's what gets the people. So
100%. And what I found a lot of the time too is that it's the middle idea that really takes off, right? When you're, you know, when you're feeling like you're at the height of your craft and at the height of complexity, a lot of time people will identify with that as being inaccessible, right? It's like, you have, okay, probably an example of that is John Mayer. John Mayer's got all these like cool bluesy songs, but nobody gives a shit, right? The stuff that goes big is like that top 40, mm-hmm. you know, that pop stuff, which is like his middle idea. But he knows that because he's John Mayer and he's the shit and he can do that. But even he's like, recognize that. It's like, it's a lot of time. It's that middle idea. And that rang true for me. And that taught me a pretty valuable lesson, which is that, you know, shit is, it's subjective. Like, just because you don't think that it's good, it doesn't mean that nobody else will. And sometimes it's worth taking the chance to just put it out there and see what happens, right? It's part of this whole idea that I have around testing things. Like sometimes just test something that, and just like be like, I don't know, but here it is, right? Have the courage to do that. And sometimes every once in a while.
It's just a post. It's just a thought.
Just a post. Just a pot. Yeah, just a thought. And then, you know, if it doesn't do anything, everybody forgets about it. Like it, and it just goes away and nobody cares. Right. So it's like, it's worth taking the time, put something out there that's kind of weird. And if it catches and goes off to do something, that's awesome. If it doesn't, it'll just fizzle out because there's so much media out there that, you know, nobody's going to care. Like nobody's going to remember 6 months ago that you posted something that didn't get any traction.
Oh, right? I'm going to rib you in like 3 years. Remember that post you got that only got 4 likes and one comment from your mom? Anyway.
Sure.
So we're going to cut this off, but how can people check out what posts you have or what's on your mind or what coffee you're drinking?
The best place, because I'm at the top of my 5,000 person limit on my personal Facebook, is my page.
So
yeah, what's the URL? It's facebook.com/Raymond Rasmussen. Go figure, that one wasn't taken already. So booyah.
Booyakasha. And are you on the Instagram? Are you on the Twitter?
I am.
But Facebook's your biggest outlet, would you say?
Facebook is my pillar platform. That's for sure.
Okay.
Instagram and Twitter, I'm there too. I get almost no interaction on Twitter. Nobody likes me there. Instagram, I have a little bit more. What's the name on there? I think it's the Entreposition, which is really hard to say. That was going to be a whole thing I was going to do. I decided not to do it. But yeah, you can't find me on Instagram. But
you can
honestly,
find you on Facebook. I found you on Facebook. Fuck it. So
the good stuff, honestly, the way I've got this whole flow of how my content works, the good stuff, the most pure stuff starts on Facebook, and then I find ways to reformat it for Instagram and Twitter. So the good stuff,
engagement. So I guess the next few weeks we've got Eddie Deal on the show, who works for PeerTrax, which is an up and coming, I guess, crypto, Bitcoin, whatever words. I am still learning about it, and I am definitely not an expert like most of the quote-unquote experts in my Facebook feed, and the quote-unquote is extremely necessary. We also have Taylor Anspaugh coming on the following week, who plays in the band Taylor and the Apes. And again, we don't usually have musicians on the show, but we're going to talk about being a working musician in New York City, which is one of the two more expensive cities in America than LA, New York and San Francisco. So I have no idea how the hell they do that. And also, how the hell they go grocery shopping, because like going on a subway with a shit ton of groceries must suck. So thank you to Ray. Thank you to Emily for editing. And every single Tuesday at 5 o'clock, I actually stammered in the intro, but I won't now. 5 o'clock Pacific time, 8 o'clock Eastern time. The show is on every single Tuesday, every single Sunday morning, bright and early, 5 a.m. Pacific time, 8 a.m. Eastern time. You can go on iTunes, subscribe to every episode. Well, just subscribe to the show and download every episode. Go to adobe.com. And any final thoughts, Ray, before we get the hell off?
One thing I want people to know is that there is so much opportunity in the music industry now. This idea that there's no money and there's no opportunity out there is just a fallacy. I think we're getting closer and closer to developing what I think is going to be an extremely strong creative middle class, and I can't wait to watch it happen.
Well said, Obama. Thank you very much, Robama. Enjoy your coffee. Enjoy everything that you do. I really, really appreciate your time.
I appreciate yours as well, man.